Hey folks, this is Always Be Watching. My name's Dan Barrett. I'll be joined by Simon Foster in just a moment. This week, it is a Bond movie release week. I never thought this day would come. Was it going to be this month? Was it going to be 5 months ago? Was it going to be 3 years ago? Who really knows? But we've got it. There's a brand new James Bond movie, which means that as is legally required as members of media outlets, we need to make sort of jokes about things being stirred and not shaken, all that business. So we will be obliging by our legally mandated obligations, and stick around for that. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Hey there, folks. Screen Watching, that is the podcast you're listening to. This is our weekly deep dive into the new movies and TV shows that have dropped during the week. And we'll also be taking a look at the week ahead and discussing some of the deeper ideas in the world of film and all things televisual. My name, it is Dan Barrett. I'm joined here by Simon Foster. Simon Foster, I'm excited to talk to you this morning because you have launched the Sydney Sci-Fi Film Festival. Sorry, Science Fiction Film Festival. Now, you've had a busy week. First of all, how are you feeling? Tell me, like, how's the week been?
Well, as we record this, we have a video linked to each other, so you can see how I'm feeling. It's been a very, it's an exhausting week. We launched on Thursday evening. We're recording this on Saturday. We launched on Thursday evening to good numbers. We had a good crowd, and I was very sort of excited about the days ahead. The film called The Blazing World was a Donnie Darko type of sort of dark fantasy thriller that I thought was going to really divide the audience, but everybody loved it. So that was a bonus. Last night, Friday evening, always a little tough for ticket sales. For some reason, there's a million different things going on around Sydney on a Friday night. We're up against the first weekend of No Time to Die, the Bond film, the last weekend of the Sydney Film Festival. Sydney was deluged by an appropriately apocalyptic downpour last night, so it was a little tough getting crowds for our Friday session, but that's kind of traditional. That's a tough sell, but we're heading into our weekend, and that's always exciting.
Yeah, I find it weird that Friday's a bit of a tough sell. Like, I appreciate this year, even if I didn't have the kid, it would be rough motivating me to leave the house purely because working from home now, it's just hard to want to leave and go and do things in the evening.
It's probably
quite easy if you live... Yeah, if you live like close to the city and actually have things in like sort of very comfortable distance from you, but because I'm a bit further out in the suburbs, like I have to make an effort to go places, and that's just difficult. So even though I wanted to come along to some sci-fi film festival stuff, one, I'm stuck with this kid at home, so I probably can't really go out and engage in the way I'd like to. But also two, like it's just hard at the end of the workday to go, you know what? I can't be bothered. It's too much.
Thank you, Dan, for caring. Look,
it's not you.
We discussed this last night. We thought, you know, everybody, we came out of the lockdown and we all got very excited that, oh, we're all going to go out and run around and do everything. But the thing is, a lot of us got very used to being at home and finding ways to entertain ourselves at home, not just sitting in front of the television with the Netflixes and the Amazons, but actually sort of enjoying our own company or the company of those that we live with and love. So it is now an extra hurdle for film festivals and all sort of event organisers to actually get people up out of their chairs. And traditionally, Sydney hasn't been an easy uptake for when you're launching a festival. It is tough to get people to go along to these sort of events. I was having this discussion last night that if this was Rome or Paris or LA, these events are kind of celebrated, and you could pretty much open an event like this and you'd start from a base of about 40 or 50 people turning up. But here in Sydney, that's not the case. There was one film, our first movie last night, a terrific little dinosaur sort of comedy thriller called Claw. I worked on for 9 months. I've been promoting and writing about and getting out there and talking about over the last month or so. We maybe had 15 people in the audience, which is kind of standard. I've been to Sydney Film Festival sessions where they only had 15 or 20 people in the audience. So just getting people to make that jump. And this might even lead us down an even bigger path, and I'm going on a bit of a ramble here, so I apologise.
Please do.
This might take us down a bigger path where we discuss the divide between the massive social media impact all our work on our Facebooks and our Twitters can get. And my numbers have surged on Facebook over the last month. So everybody's looking and reading about the festival that I want to, but there's this period, there's this sort of chasm of conversion, I guess you could call it, where getting people to actually click the button, buy the ticket, come to the event, that I don't think Facebook or Twitter or Instagram answers.
Yeah, it's not so much an awareness or interest issue. It's really just a motivation issue.
That's exactly right, a call to action. Yeah, that's what it is. So, but it's been a great week. The support we've had and the patrons who've come along have enjoyed everything so far, and ahead of us as we record this today is a very big sort of Saturday program and our Sunday closing night. So, yeah, love doing it. Love the people. Love the filmmakers.
Yeah, I actually think Sydney's a bit of a garbage cinema movie town.
Me too. I absolutely agree. Yeah,
I think we've got some great theaters here. So like the Ritz and the Orpheum are pretty fantastic. Sure. In terms of going to like a CBD and going to like a theater complex, George Street, like it's such a. I remember the first time I went to George Street, and it was like a Saturday. Like I was just in town, just as a tourist with a couple of buddies, and we went and saw. Do you remember that movie Changing Lanes? Samuel Jackson,
yeah. Ben Affleck
film. Yep. Really good film. I really love that film, but. Yeah. I remember we were like in the Big Smoke. We were in Sydney. It was like, you know, big and exciting. It was a Saturday night. And we went in there and we had to go through about like four or five different ticket checkers to get through there. And it felt so big and cavernous. Now I go to the George Street cinemas and it's like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But back then, like there was something really big and grand about going to the George Street cinema.
Yeah. Melbourne's got the Astor, and I know Adelaide's got Mercury, and Brisbane's got a couple of great retro cinemas as well. But cinema going as a culture has always... Outside of the big blockbuster releases, you're kind of always preaching to the converted when you get audiences to these type of cinemas and these type of events. So it would be great. Imagine living in LA where, you know, on any different block you've got some sort of retro cinema screening and the whole sort of
LA is an entirely different beast though, isn't it?
Oh, for sure, yeah. But I guess that's the point, that it's, we'd love to have that kind of love for cinema and love for exploring different types of movies in our cinemas here in Australia.
Yeah. Anyway, Simon, let's dive into some reviews because that's what people are here for.
It stinks.
Now, in the spirit, Simon, of keeping people waiting for what they actually want to hear, which is a James Bond review, how about we dive in first to a brand new series that's dropping on Paramount Plus called Yellow Jackets.
The question is, what really happened out there?
Like any hot-blooded one.
We scavenged. We starved.
After they rescued us, I lost my purpose. I can't imagine what you guys went through out there.
Don't eat that kind. It's poisonous.
Like kill you poisonous or like trip your balls off poisonous.
There's an incredible tightrope being walked by the pilot for the show Yellow Jackets. It takes a very familiar conceit. Here we've got the split timeline where in the mid-90s, we see a plane crash with a girls' team of bitchy soccer players who land in the middle of nowhere, crash land in the middle of nowhere. And then you've got a timeline in a modern day where we follow some of the survivors who are really messed up because of what happened to them in the wilderness of Canada. Some really nasty shit went on 20 years ago, and no one's talking about what really actually went on. It's a Lord of the Flies retelling, infused with the delectable mystery box of Lost. And the show takes this very familiar idea and wraps it up in a very dark and suspenseful mystery. For the entire pilot episode, you will be gripped as the show grabs hold of you and demands that nobody looks down off the high wire that is this pilot. But there's only so long that a story like this can keep you from noticing that you're not on a high wire at all, but you're actually only a meter off the ground, and you've simply been dazzled by incredible showmanship. And it is incredible showmanship. The pilot for the Yellow Jackets is deftly directed by Karen Kusama. She's best known for her debut film Girl Fight back in the day, but since then she's built up impressive filmography, which includes the Nicole Kidman film Destroyer, along with a very healthy resume of directing on a number of high-profile premium TV dramas. And as strong as the direction is, what really makes the show sparkle is the adult cast of women playing the grown-up survivors. It's a cast who are mostly remembered for their own body of work as teenagers. You got actors like Melanie Lynskey, Christina Ricci, and Juliette Lewis. And it's with the second episode of the show that the audience will begin to realise that they've been overly taken with the theatrics of the first episode. Very quickly, the show settles into simply being a very good retread of Lord of the Flies. Yes, you want to see what happens to the girls after the plane crash, but you won't be hungry for it like you were with the first episode. And as the show starts to settle into the need to pace itself and the events that take place outside of the wilderness, the show starts to feel very familiar and it treads a much more obvious path. Lord of the Flies meets Mean Girls is one heck of a proposition in itself. And even though the show starts out really strong before forcing you to settle into what's merely a rather good drama that's impeccably cast with known actors putting in knockout performances, don't let that shift in engagement with the show prevent you from going along with the show. It's a really good watch in the subsequent episodes that occasionally elevates itself up to being really quite great. And I want to end my spiel here with an acknowledgement of the trio of Melanie Lynskey, Christina Ricci, and Juliette Lewis. Nobody's going into the show thinking that any of them were underappreciated, but episode after episode of the show will have you feeling like maybe we have actually underappreciated all three actors. Their stock after the series will be at an all-time high. And as I said, Yellow Jackets is streaming this week on Paramount Plus.
Mate, you should get a job with the Paramount Plus marketing team, because what you've just said about the series Yellow Jackets there has completely got me hooked. Maybe because I'm under the cloud of being a festival director at the moment, I hadn't even heard about this, but that cast...
Nobody has.
That cast, that premise, and the clincher of Karen Kusama, of whom I'm a huge fan... I'm hooked. This sounds like the go-to TV for after the festival for me.
Yeah, it's got a lot going for it. And it's interesting hearing some of the reviews coming out of US critics who've taken a look at this, because the general vibe, the consensus, I guess, for all of them is that it's a stellar pilot that has become sort of far less good. But even though it is far less good, I don't want people losing sight of the fact that even though it's far less good, it's just stepping down from what's an incredible pilot. It just sort of steps down to being a rather good TV show as opposed to being a great knockout TV show, which that pilot sort of sets up the expectations for. So even the worst episode of the show is still going to be better than most things you're watching this week, I guarantee it.
From the sublime to the ridiculous, I managed to see Home Sweet Home Alone last night.
My mum and dad have gone to Tokyo. I'm totally on my own.
You do realise that my 10-year-old son is at home by himself. You just assumed Max was on the other flight.
We didn't take a census.
We got reports of suspicious people around 36 Lincoln Ave.
I can't go to jail, honey. I wouldn't last 30 seconds in Gen Pop. It's where fresh fish get got.
Nobody here is getting got.
Man, we really are letting people wait for Bond, aren't we?
We really are.
Simon, tell me about the Home Alone 7. Film?
Well, that's part of the concern I have with this. Is it lore? Is it part of the ongoing sort of McAllister legacy that was set up all those years ago, 1990, in fact, in the wonderful original movie Home Alone with the fabulous Macaulay Culkin? Now, they're not words I put together generally, the fabulous Macaulay Culkin, but when you see the young man...
Wait, fair go. Party Monster, he was pretty good at that.
Pretty good.
There was that movie, was it Saved, where he's in a wheelchair? Or was the religious teen comedy?
Yeah, that was fine with Mandy Moore. Look, I'm not anti-Macaulay Culkin. He's done some really good work, none more so than in...
Sounded like you're anti-Macaulay. Sorry, go on.
None more so than the original Home Alone. The objectionable little twerp who plays the lead in Home Sweet Home Alone has to be the most unlikable actor I've seen on screen in a long time. Now, I was reminded just before this podcast that he was the chubby best friend in Jojo Rabbit, and he had a couple of scenes in that which, you know, qualified him as comic relief. But in Home Sweet Home Alone, he plays this nasty little piece of work who is just so monotonous on screen. His delivery is so bland. It just makes you recall the wonder that was Macaulay Culkin's performance in the first series of films. It is also a film that has a terrible problem with the basic premise. We all remember the Wet Bandits in the first film in Home Alone. Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern, they were nasty, comically villainous characters who deserved everything that young Kevin McAllister thrust upon them. In Home Sweet Home, you have Rob Delaney and Ellie, what's the actress's name? Ellie Kemper. They play a married couple. They have to break into the young man's home to get back an expensive antique doll that the young boy stole from them. So he's now unleashing all these terrible plots and all these horrific pranks, causing terrible physical damage on this young married couple who are only trying to get back what is theirs anyway. There's a misunderstanding which sort of ties it all together, and they want to help you make it believable, but it's a terribly unfunny premise that makes the violence perpetrated upon Delaney and Kemper just really tough to watch. You've also got someone that you know is one of my favorite people in the world, Aisling Bea, as the role played by Catherine O'Hara in the first film. This is
the mother.
The mother. And she has to do some really heavy lifting to get laughs out of this. There's some very questionable scenes at a Japanese airport. There's some very questionable humor using German accents. This is all within the sort of the parameters of a Disney film. The terrible thing is that none of it is funny. There isn't a laugh to be had. And generally at this point, you're able to go with it might be okay for families. I would say it isn't. Some of the violence is really heavy and things like pins in the tips of the fingers and billiard balls to the forehead and all that sort of stuff. Without the...
I'm laughing already.
Yeah, this is your sort of television. Look, it's part of the Disney Empire's rebranding, rehashing, reimagining of old, you know, properties. And that can work sometimes and has worked, you know, with some big screen movies over the last couple of years and, of course, with, you know, The Mandalorian and some of the TV stuff. But this one is just every bit as awful as some of the reports coming out of the US suggest it is. So give Home Sweet Home Alone a wide berth.
I was kind of interested in this one mostly because of the cast. So first of all, let's talk about Archie Yates, who's the young kid playing former Kevin McAllister role. Well, I heard that it was the kid from Jojo Rabbit, so I thought it was the main kid from Jojo Rabbit. And then I watched the trailer yesterday morning and I'm like, wait a second, that's not that kid.
Unless he's let himself go really badly, but...
Well, that's it. Like, the kid who was the Jojo Rabbit, like, main guy, yeah. Like, surely he'd be a great Kevin McAllister sort of a replacement in that they kind of look the same.
Yeah, that's a great point. You're absolutely right. That would have been good casting. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, even in the trailer, like, Archie Yates, like, the line delivery just seemed garbage.
Yeah, it was.
But I was very excited by Ellie Kemper and Rob Delaney. Like, that seemed like a really great pairing, and I love those two. When I say Ellie Kemper, I should say former KKK beauty queen Ellie Kemper and Catastrophe's Rob Delaney.
Hashtag allegedly, but yeah. Look, the cast does go on for a long way. You've got Kenan Thompson in there. You've got, and I should have looked up his name, but the guy who played the mean older brother in the original Home Alone, who owned the spider ultimately did horrible things to Joe Pesci. He plays a cop. He comes back and plays the small town suburban cop in this one in a couple of small scenes. But yeah, the cast goes on.
I should just point out here, the actor's name is Devin Rattray and the character was Buzz McAllister.
Buzz McAllister, that's right. So he's in there.
Justice for Rattray, I see.
And there's certainly some nods. There's even a nod to the famous slap on the face, the hands on the face that Macaulay Culkin made iconic back in the original film. So it nods back to the original, but in terms of having any of the charm or comedic chops of the first and arguably the second film, just not even in the same ballpark.
Well, that's kind of sad. I sort of wanted to give it a look. I don't really know why. I knew I'd be wasting my time, but whatever. Simon Foster, in the spirit of keeping people waiting to listen to the review for No Time to Die, how about we dive into a different review? And look, like Yellow Jackets, it's the cast of The Shrink Next Door that really elevates The Shrink Next Door into being a fairly interesting watchable TV show. This is streaming now on Apple TV. Let's listen to a clip.
You're really building me up for No Time to Die. I don't have a lot to say about it, but I'll...
I'm trying to be ruler of my own domain.
This therapy is really working out, huh?
It is. It really is.
The goal of life is to live.
We'll turn you into the man you truly deserve to be.
This doctor's a little unconventional.
He's a miracle worker.
What is he doing here?
Helping us. What do you think?
So much fun.
Is that... allowed?
Well, I did the work, didn't I?
He's changed my life.
The Shrink Next Door, it's got the reluctant Marty Markowitz visiting a psychiatrist for the first time. He's a man in his late 30s who recently lost both of his parents, and he's just taken over the family business. It's a textiles company that makes curtains. He's crippled with self-doubt and has an overall lack of self-confidence. He's been hiding from the world since he was a kid, and that's hurt him in his personal and professional interactions. He goes to visit Dr. Isaac Ike Hirschkopf, or as we get to know him, Dr. Ike. He seems to be a fairly good-natured, evenly tempered presence who's very much on Marty's energy level. Marty responds well to him, and so a relationship is born. It's almost a friendship, but there is always that pretense of, you know, we are sort of patient and doctor. Now, what Marty doesn't realize is that Ike isn't as professional as he seems, and the relationship becomes abusive, with Ike taking control of Marty's life for his own reward. In the lead roles, we've got Will Ferrell as Marty and his Anchorman co-star Paul Rudd as Dr. Ike. Both are bearded and playing very Jewish men, even though neither actor is Jewish, so there is a bit of Jew face going on. And we've got the third major cast member here, Catherine Hahn, and she's playing Marty's sister. Hahn herself had a small supporting role in Anchorman and has appeared a number of times on screen opposite Ferrell and Rudd in a number of films and a few TV shows. All three have dynamic chemistry, and that's really what drives the show. Don't be expecting, though, broad Anchorman-level comedy here. All the performances are all quite different to that. It's almost as though they went to the set on day one with the desire to play their roles as muted as possible, but upon filming also decides to dial up the mannerisms of each role a good 75%. All three put in very specific performances. Hahn is especially strong in the show, but I find her endlessly watchable generally. And while I like the performances and the general mood of the show, which is well crafted by former Kids in a Hall star Michael Showalter, the show doesn't feel especially substantial in an episodic format. Everything here feels better suited to a movie, where you can walk away with an experience of having lived in the shoes of the characters for 100-ish minutes, before walking away with a strong impression of the story. With 8 40-ish minute episodes, it's demanding too much of a viewer to really care for that long. This is a show with some very strong elements, but I don't know how much folks are going to be remembering to come back each week to watch the next episode of the show.
Gee, you know, it's interesting. Your reviews this week, as opposed to my reviews, have featured some really significant star power. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's a further step along the path of breaking down the original and the traditional movie star Hollywood role, where people like Ferrell and Rudd are big screen performers, and they're finding these new types of careers in well-written small screen projects. And The Shriek Next Door, just on that cast alone, including Catherine Hahn, has me hooked. So I'm keen to see where they take these kind of characters, because the dramatic stuff that both the actors have done, especially Ferrell in some of his quieter, more dramatic moments, I find him a really sort of compelling character to watch. So this is interesting to me, The Shriek Next Door on Apple TV Plus.
Yeah, Ferrell's definitely a little bit stronger than Rudd is, but I mean, Rudd is so charming and charismatic, but he does get lost behind his beard in the show, which is kind of a bit interesting. But you kind of tapped upon the big issue here, which is that, and we've talked about this, and we're not the only ones talking about this, this is a fairly broad conversation that's happening everywhere, but just that idea that we're seeing the big, massive tentpole movies that are dominating cinema screens. You've got these small indies, but those mid-tier movies are disappearing. 5-10 years ago, like, this series would have been one of these mid-tier movies. Yep. That would have been made for $20-30 million. It would have gotten a fairly sizable audience coming along to it. Not a massive audience, but it doesn't need a huge audience to recoup costs. Yeah. But it'd just be one of these films where you'd go along, you'd enjoy it for the hour and a half to 2 hours that it'd run for. And, you know, moments of it would possibly stick with you and it'd become possibly a beloved film, or at least one that you've got sort of fond memories of. But we're now in this phase where the mid-tier movie is now being stretched out into these sort of 5-6 to 8 episode serial runs. And I just don't think it necessarily translates. I'd prefer to see this as a movie, and I would have had such a stronger reaction to this if it was a short, contained story, as opposed to really allowing you to spend time with the characters, because, quite frankly, it's pretty rare that there's a character you need to spend that much time with to really sort of revel in, like, their... Like, unless it's a hangout show where you actually just want to hang out with these characters on a regular basis, you don't need to spend 8 episodes with a character to understand what they're about and what makes them tick. Sometimes less is much more.
It also speaks to the something that I've sort of got strong opinions on, the delineating or even the disappearance of, quote-unquote, the movie star. You go back 30 years, you had Schwarzenegger, Julia Roberts, Tom Cruise. You go back 20 years, you had Jim Carrey, you had Tom Cruise. Now, the only real movie star in the world in terms of the person who can open a movie in every country is still Tom Cruise. Otherwise, it's Spider-Man, or it's MCU, or it's a character that promotes a film now and drives box office rather than any kind of name player. So, yeah, that may be a discussion for another day, but it's a valid one.
I mean, I would say I think The Rock occupies a certain space where he can open a movie, but at the same time, like, I'd say he's probably like the last sort of new movie star that's come along. Yeah. But also, last night I did watch Jungle Cruise on Disney Plus, and my God, I found that to be such a struggle.
Yeah, oh, me too.
That was maybe one of the... that was dreadful. Mm. And while it may not have played on the big screen, on the small screen, every defect with all the special effects is very much on display. And boy, that was...
It was a slog.
It was something.
Yeah. It was something, all right. Oh, we got anything else to review? Oh, yeah, this small independent film we should talk about. It's called No Time to Die.
Why would I betray you?
We all have our secrets. We just didn't get to yours yet.
Okay, Simon, eagerly anticipated, not just on this podcast, but also the world were pretty excited to go and see a new James Bond film. Now, quietly, I'm not a huge James Bond fan. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure how you feel about the franchise, but tell us about the movie, and then let's talk about Bond a bit broadly afterwards. All right,
so the film is called No Time to Die. It is Daniel Craig's last performance in the role. If you haven't been a Bond fan, you won't certainly connect with the trajectory that the James Bond character has gone on under Daniel Craig. I have found his films to be terribly uneven. There's been some greats amongst them, and there's been some dogs. So with No Time to Die, you stumble into this final element of his franchise role as the super agent, and it plays out exactly as you expect it to. Unfortunately, and I'm not going to go too heavily into plot here because A, it's largely inconsequential when you're talking about a Bond film, and B, it's usually really convoluted, which it is here. So plot-wise, you can pretty much assume that there's a villain, in this case played by Rami Malek. There's a couple of beautiful women that have some impact upon James Bond's life, in this case played by Lea Seydoux and the wonderful Ana de Armas. Plus you have him sort of railing against authority, in this case played by the returning Ralph Fiennes, and all the traditional characters like Q, played by Ben Whishaw, and some others. So Naomi Harris's Moneypenny. So you know what you're going for when you go into No Time to Die, other than the ending, which has been heavily publicized in roundabout ways as being Daniel Craig's final performance, and that's left, unless there's some sort of weird kind of flashback Bond down the track, this will clearly be Daniel Craig's last film. What Craig has done and done well is deconstructed the character down to sort of more elemental human characteristics, and by that I mean, we came out of the Pierce Brosnan era realizing how silly the whole Bond thing was with some of the more sillier films in the franchise. And Daniel Craig's role was to give it grit, was to give it a modern man's sort of perspective, was to make him a more real human figure. And ultimately, that's a little bit of the undoing of No Time to Die. The last half hour of this film descends into kind of a more personal struggle, and I'm not really that interested in hearing about that side of Bond. There will be those who have said it's the perfect way to wrap up the Daniel Craig era, those who have warmed to him as the Bond character, but in every other respect, this to me is an action film that feels of the time rather than beyond it, and the best Bond films are Bond films which sort of challenge the genre, sort of move it forward, move it ahead. This feels very much of the Jason Bourne type, you know, Liam Neeson type of action movies that are a dime a dozen nowadays. So in not giving too much away about the plot, it's a fairly short review, but I think No Time to Die falls in the mid-range of Bond movies. It's no, and I'm going out on a limb here, and this might get emails if we had an email address. I'm saying that Timothy Dalton is my favourite Bond, and the best of the Bond films were a couple of his and some of the Sean Connery ones. And I think that No Time to Die falls just behind them, but well ahead of Moonraker and Octopussy.
Are you generally a huge Bond guy? Like, do you get excited about a James Bond movie?
I like the, and respond to the sort of reputation and iconic position he has in film culture and film history. So when a new one comes along, I want to see how that is portrayed on the screen. Does that mean I'm a huge Bond fan and have all the DVDs lined up on my DVD shelf? No, I don't. There are some I've only seen once. I've seen them all, but I don't often return to a Bond movie. So yes, I want to watch it, but it's not my go-to movie character on a rainy afternoon.
I don't know. I always find myself just a bit cold by James Bond films in that it's the sort of thing that I want to really enjoy. Mm. Like, it's got all the hallmarks of something which I'd love. But any time that I sit through a James Bond movie, I expect it to reach the heights, the sort of enthusiasm and just jaw-droppingness that I feel any time I watch one of the Mission Impossible movies, yep, like one of the Tom Cruise Impossible films. And I never feel that with these James Bond movies. If anything, I always find myself, like, those Mission Impossible films they're questionable in terms of some of the plot, and they sort of bounce all over the place. But a James Bond film is far worse from that. The structural integrity of almost any James Bond script is just non-existent. Yeah. And I don't know, it just frustrates me every time. Like, they just feel insubstantial every Every film.
Yeah, look, I think the hardest thing that the James Bond producers, old and new, have had to deal with is keeping him relevant in these times, keeping what was a Cold War era character who had, you know, the general public's fear and contempt for the other side of the world to play with, to keep him relevant. And I think that's what they've really tried to do with Daniel Craig. They've and see, even Daniel Craig himself, and I'll sidetrack myself here, Daniel Craig sort of, to me, he looks like the hottest dad at school pickup. And I don't know if I warm to him as a movie star specifically. I much prefer him in things like Logan Lucky or Knives Out, where he gets to play sort of beyond that hardened Bond edge. I've never really convinced by him as Bond. And the fact that they've had to sort of modernize Bond and make him a more everyman, emotional man kind of figure to keep the Bond character relevant, I don't think has served the character well. This is a very controversial opinion because so many people love the Daniel Craig films, and so many, certainly younger listeners, have responded to him as being a more real human being than he was back in the days of Moore and Pierce Brosnan. So will you go and see No Time to Die? Does this hold a must-see sort of feel for you?
Look, I'm definitely going to go and see it. So I don't think there's any of the films that have come out since I've been sort of like from my teenage years onwards that I haven't gone to see. But at the same time, I do know I'm just going to be a little disappointed by the experience of it. So look, I'm enthused, but I'm not super enthused to get along to this point.
Okay, no time.
But my question for you, Simon, is there's questions now. So obviously Daniel Craig's not coming back in Bond. Is there anyone around at the moment that you'd like to see take on the Bond mantle?
Oh, man. It's going to be a tough ask for the producers to fill that role. I think Henry Cavill is front and center as
he's my guy.
As a potential Bond, it's going to be, boy, what a sort of career trajectory to him to have played America's superhero and now to have played Britain and now to potentially play Britain's ultimate superhero. So, I think the role that he played in the last Mission Impossible film where he took on Tom Cruise in that terrific bathroom fight sequence shows that he's a tough man and a tough actor who can also pull off the gentler, quieter, more personable stuff. So probably Cavill.
The thing with Bond that I think Cavill imbues is that he's got the charisma.
Yep.
Like Henry Cavill, like, just oozes charisma. He's a very charming guy. Yep. And also don't forget that he was Napoleon Solo in the film adaptation of Man from U.N.C.L.E., Like, that was a film that sort of came and went and not enough people gave it its due. But if you didn't check out the Man from U.N.C.L.E. Film reboot, like, check that one out. That is incredibly fun, yeah. Incredibly charming. And it really just speaks to the heart of what makes Henry Cavill a charming Bond-like character. I mean, the TV show Man from U.N.C.L.E. was very much a response to the James Bond character and films like that at the time. So it's definitely got its roots in there. But if you want to see, like, a proto-Bond-Henry Cavill role, like, this is the place to go. Also, Armie Hammer's pretty charming in that, and I've always found Hammer to be a little bit charmless, and I never really quite understood Armie Hammer until I watched this film.
Yes, I thought you were going to say that Armie Hammer should sort of front up for the next James Bond performance. I think,
oh God, no.
I think the Armie Hammer fail boat has sort of left the dock already. So, No Time to Die in cinemas.
The best thing Armie Hammer could be really rolled out for these days is like a Hannibal reboot.
Yeah. Google Armie Hammer, everyone, so you know what Dan's talking about.
Google the two phrases, Armie Hammer and recipe.
Oh, God. No Time to Die in cinemas everywhere.
Simon, the delectable creamy center, the nougaty center of this podcast is the weekly middle bit. And this week, you've got something for us. Run me through this. What are we talking
about? Desperation kicked in when I realized 3 minutes before the podcast started that we didn't have a screen watching middle bit. And then I realized that this week we celebrate the birthday of one Meg Ryan. We'll get to that later on in the birthday segment. But it made me think, whatever happened to Meg Ryan? And maybe led me to think further, what ex-stars need to be Tarantino'd? Now, by that, I mean, who are the great stars of yesteryear that need a career resurgent courtesy of the great QT, like he did for John Travolta, like he did for Pam Grier, Robert Foster, that small role that Luke Perry had in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? He has a golden touch with sort of bringing, discovering the inner workings of the fallen star and making them shine once again. So who are the stars that maybe Quentin Tarantino could take under his wing and say, hey, let's make you great again?
Hey, you know what's interesting? Sorry, just before we get to your premise here for the thing, you mentioned the Luke Perry role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that I think that Luke Perry caught everyone's attention, and that was like the immediate thing, but it kind of feels like in the last 2 years since that film came out, it's not really that Luke Perry role, and obviously that's tempered by the fact that he did pass away shortly after the film was produced. But the person that seems to have really broken out of that film is Nicholas Hammond. He was playing, what's the actor's name? It was like Wanamaker?
Yeah, exactly. Nicholas Hammond, who we remember from Sound of Music and later Spider-Man. So that's exactly the sort of casting that some of these actors that we've got a list of in front of us need. That sort of inside and let's take a risk on a faded former star or faded former actor. That it's a strange sort of dynamic because Nicholas Hammond he wasn't like an A-list star or anything. He wasn't a huge presence on screen, but he's an actor that a lot of people know and a lot of people love, like Luke Perry to a certain extent. There's a lot of affection for, and Tarantino has this terrific way of being able to cast these types of actors and bring out all the potential that we knew they had over the years. But he's also good at resurrecting stars. So why don't you kick off? Let's mention some of the ones on your list.
Okay, so as you said, we only really came up with this literally about 3 minutes before we hit the record button and got started. So I put together a list, and somehow I've actually got a bit of a sizable list here. Okay. So this is my list. I'm just going to start rattling off some names, and as they, you know, pique your interest, let's have a bit of a chat. Sure. So the first name that came to mind was Campbell Scott. And people may remember Campbell Scott as an indie film star really through the 90s was probably sort of his peak.
Yes.
Films you've seen Campbell Scott in, Singles is probably his biggest film. I'm really fond of him from the film Roger Dodger, where he starred opposite a young Jesse Eisenberg trying to essentially be, it wasn't really being quite a pickup artist, but trying to teach Jesse Eisenberg the ways of the Lothario man in New York in the mid-90s.
I remember Campbell Scott very fondly from the Julia Roberts film Dying Young. He was the sick patient.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The Spanish Prisoner is another one of my favorites, and he was very good in a lead role there. So Campbell Scott, I think, is definitely someone who maybe hasn't even really sort of had a moment in the sun to have what would be seen as a comeback, but he was kind of like an actor who sort of almost cut through.
Good choice.
But I mean, that's probably no different to Robert Forster, really, in some regards, but he's sort of top of my list. Someone I would love to see in a career revival is Judge Reinhold.
Oh, that is exactly what I'm talking about. That's the sort of actor who we all love and we all want to see do great things, and Tarantino could cast him in a role that we're not expecting, and he'd be great. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. And it's not like Reinhold necessarily had a huge amount of range. He was definitely a very specific type. But, like, maybe he does have the range. We never got the chance to see it. So, you know, he's on my list.
That's a great one. Yeah, good one. What's next?
I've got three names on my list here, and some people will hear these names and go, Dan Barrett, I think you've got a type. So here we go. Mia Sara from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Okay. I'd love to see her give something fairly substantial. She hasn't really done much on screen for a while. Yeah. So I think the last time that she was really sort of seen doing anything was a very small role sitting in the audience of a very good special that everybody needs to see that I don't think people have actually seen. It's a magic special. It's Derek, and what's the guy's surname? Delgaudio's.
Yes.
Derek Delgaudio's In and of Itself. If you haven't seen the special, find a way to watch the special. It's not available here in Australia legitimately as far as I'm aware. It's certainly available quite easily across the US and a few other territories.
I think it's fair to say that the Mia Sara star has fallen considerably if he's playing an audience member at a magic show.
Yeah, I mean, she's not playing an audience member. She's just Mia Sara in the audience of this magic show. And she's seen briefly on screen for a second and a half. And I'm like, wait, it's Mia Sara. But anyway, right. Mia Sara, she hasn't really done much for about like 10 to 15 years at this point on screen. Okay, so next on my list of women who kind of look the same, Olivia Williams from Rushmore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, she'd be
great. She hasn't quite gone away.
No, she's always working and she's around. But I mean, she'd be great. She's a terrific actress. I remember, of course, as a ghost wife in The Sixth Sense. Spoiler alert.
Absolutely. Yeah. she's not actually a ghost. Or was she?
No, she wasn't a ghost. She was the wife of a ghost.
No, she was the
because
wife of
Bruce Willis. Because Bruce Willis died at the start of the film, and you think he's alive through the whole movie, but he's actually dead. Did I give him? I probably shouldn't have said that.
I just worked out our middle segment for next week, where we just tell people what happens in movies, where there's a plot twist at the end. Okay, and number three on my list of women who kind of all look the same, Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah. But once again, still a major star and still working. But yes, she would be wonderful in a Tarantino film. And yes, that is a very sort of definitive group of people that you'd certainly have a taste for.
Yeah, very much so. Okay, we should probably throw a blonde into the mix here. Daryl Hannah.
Yes, Daryl Hannah's good. Returning in Tarantino film because she starred in featured in the Kill Bill movies, of course.
She did. I got to meet Daryl Hannah once. She was lovely in person. I really liked her.
I mean, I understand she's quite, eccentric in many regards, but yeah, I'm sure she's lovely.
Yeah, I mean, she was a little bit sort of standoffish, but also it was a weird sort of social environment we were in. So,
and she's got that.
Whatever.
She's got that fishtail as well, which makes it difficult.
Yeah, I mean, that surprised me. I wasn't expecting to see that. I thought that was just a thing for that movie she was in. So, I think it was really good for the rest of her career that they just sort of green screened that tail out. Moving on, Dennis Quaid. I think he's very much perfect. Due for a revival.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That sort of actor. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah, he's a very offbeat choice. Right. Charles Marston Smith.
Wow. Yeah, that's an interesting one. He would play a very, I could see him in a smaller kind of crotchety, villainous type of role in a Tarantino film. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, he's suddenly an older gentleman at this point. Now, Charles Martin Smith was constantly working through the late 60s into the mid to late 80s.
Yep.
People would probably know him best from films like American Graffiti, The Untouchables, obviously. Very substantial role there. He's since moved into a TV directing career. So he directed, I think, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer pilot. Okay. Not the pilot, but the first episode of that series. And he's suddenly been a presence sort of behind the screen for quite a while. But I'd love to see him have like that one last great role on screen because I'm very fond of that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you ever see his movie Never Cry Wolf, the one where he went into the Alaskan wilderness? That's one of my favorite sort of nature films.
No, but I'm definitely going to give
that. Yeah, that's a great movie.
I'll give that a look. Someone, I think, due for a comeback, Helen Hunt.
Yes, well, she's kind of gone into a self-imposed sort of anonymity. She could have kept working, but just didn't. So, yeah, she's absolutely due for a comeback.
Yeah, well, she chose to go off and raise her child. And so she's been appearing in the TV series Blindness? I don't think that's quite right. Anyway, there's a new TV show where she plays a supporting role in it, but I think that she's definitely due for a comeback. Ed Norton, who hasn't really quite gone away, but he's sort of... He's been sort of simmering on a pot for a while, and I think there's an opportunity to really bring him back in a fairly big way. But here's my big wild card entry.
All right,
Simon.
Let's hear it.
Okay. The premise of this is actors who are requiring a career resurgence in a Tarantino sort of a film. Okay, so the examples we used were Pam Grier, John Travolta, Robert Forster, etc., etc. Yep. The person that I think is desperate for a career revival in a Tarantino movie, Pam Grier.
Really? You think she disappeared significantly enough after Jackie Brown to need another shot in the arm, QT style?
Like Pam Grier was a constantly working actor right up until Jackie Brown, and then suddenly she was in Jackie Brown. People were like, oh wait, no, she's actually really quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And she's been consistently working just as much as she had been pre Jackie Brown, but without that heat around her, like she's kind of just sort of subsided into the background again. Let's bring her right back out again. I think it's due. She's fantastic.
A Jackie Brown sequel.
Well, I'm not even calling for a Jackie Brown sequel. I'm just saying, let's give her another career jab because I think she deserves it.
Oh, well, you've set the standard high for the list of actors who need to be QT'd. Can I jump into mine?
Yeah, please.
Okay, I'm going to lead off with an actress who Hollywood never quite found the right niche for, never quite figured out how to use her amazing on-screen talent, and she has returned a little bit in recent years, but I think Deborah Winger could do with a QT-ing. I think she would bring the sort of screen quality that Tarantino's a master of drawing out of his actors. I would love to see Ally Sheedy. It's very similar sort of role that she's played in Hollywood to Deborah Winger. She wanted to sort of dictate her own career and not just be the girlfriend type in a lot of movies. I would love to see what Ally Sheedy could do with a Tarantino role.
I'm wild about Ally Sheedy.
You're wild about Ally Sheedy. Yeah, I love Ally Sheedy. Yep. I wish she'd been a huge star. I would have loved to have seen her gone on to kind of edgier Jodie Foster type roles that I thought she would be fantastic to handle, but she was not done that. And she pops up occasionally. She's done some indie films, and I know she's done some TV work lately. She's certainly still working in Hollywood, but she needs that QT jab to make it happen.
I mean, it's that thing, and that's kind of changing a little bit in the last couple of years, but like there's just been so few good roles for women sort of over the age of 40 to 50.
Yeah, exactly right. I would like to see the greatest bombshell of all time Raquel Welch make a return into a QT film. I wish she'd turned up in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That would have seemed like the perfect sort of milieu, the perfect sort of setting for Raquel Welch to make an appearance in. So maybe QT could do something amazing with her. Couple of actors that I think could do with some QTing, the great George Hamilton, who, you know, with his wonderful LA tan and bouffant hair, he could certainly play a high-profile role in a Quentin Tarantino film. Now, this is my left-field one. Many of you will remember him and adore him from The A-Team. Many of you will know him from a little horror film called with all those S's in the title. Dirk Benedict is a man, is an actor I think a lot of people have a great deal of affection for, who could rise out of obscurity, be remembered, and there's sort of a great sort of back narrative, a backstory to who he is and who he was. And with that Tarantino flourish, I think Dirk Benedict could make a big splash on screen. And I'm going to throw one more in this mix, an actress that I guarantee nobody recalls. Her name is Susan Anton. She was this statuesque blonde athlete turned actress who starred in a movie called Golden Girl, which was a track and field drama that was meant to make her a movie star. It was a terrible film and flopped hopelessly, and she became famous for being Dudley Moore's spouse for a few years. She's something like 6'7", and he's just a bit over 3 foot tall. So they made a lot of fantastic red carpet photo opportunities their own back in the early 80s, mid 80s. But Susan Anton, A-N-T-O-N, give it a Google, see who she was and who she is now, and I think that Tarantino could do something special with her.
You mentioned Dirk Benedict. I'm a huge fan of him, mostly from Battlestar Galactica.
Of course.
Simon, this brings us to the end of yet another epic middle bit. At the end of the episode, we do wrap up with the look at the week ahead. There are quite a few notable TV shows and movies that are dropping this week on various streaming services. So, do you want to kick us off? What are some of the movies dropping on streaming?
Well, two of the biggest movies to hit streaming this year are a couple of Disney Plus titles. Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings is hitting Disney Plus after a pretty stellar cinema run, it must be said. And the aforementioned Jungle Cruise with one Dwayne T.R. The Rock Johnson and Emily Blunt, a film that both you and I agree with is best left unwatched, but, you know, it'll be huge on Disney Plus, as will Shang-Chi.
So I was watching Jungle Cruise last night, and I was thinking about The Rock. Now, The Rock's got his TV show. It's called Young Rock, where it's the stories of The Rock as a young man. But does that mean from now on going forward, we need to refer to the current Rock as Old Rock?
Oh, boy. I wouldn't say that to his face. Would you say that to his face?
No, probably not. I wouldn't
say that to his face. Also coming out this week is a documentary called Mayor Pete. This is an inside look at Pete Buttigieg's campaign. Buttigieg's campaign to run for president of the United States. It's on Amazon Prime and gives a pretty insightful, pretty powerful look at the machinations that sort of kick in when you want to run for the Oval Office. It's called Mayor Pete on Amazon Prime. What are the TV series that we can look forward to in the week ahead?
Yeah, look, it's actually a really jam-packed weekend that we're recording on right now for releases. You had Disney Plus Day, which means that there's a whole bunch of Disney-related TV shows and movies and stuff that have dropped on the same time. You mentioned the two big films. There's also the TV series Dope Sick, which is a look at the health crisis with opioids in the US, and this one stars Michael Keeson. Now, it's a show that debuted on Hulu a couple of months ago in the US, but it's being debuted globally on Star via Disney Plus, so we can check that out as of now, I believe. There's also, we talked about this on the show last week, Simon, Red Notice, which is the Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Ryan Reynolds, Gal Gadot film, and that's dropped on Netflix. There's also a couple other shows around, movies as well. There's a film called Passing on Netflix that you should probably mention. Yeah, this is a film with Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga and Andre Holland. It's a story about two high school friends, both African-American women, but one of them's had the ability to be able to code switch between sort of white and black, and it's about how that's impacted on their relationship over the years. So I think that's an interesting one. Also directed by Rebecca Hall, the actress Rebecca Hall.
That's a big plus. She's a terrific talent. I'm really interested to see what she can do behind the camera. Whereas Red Notice is getting some awful reviews, Passing is getting some great reviews. So that's I'm excited about that.
Absolutely. But we both know that Red Notice will have far more people watching
it. I'll be watching it.
There's a interesting doco series on Amazon Prime Video called Always Jane. And it's about a young trans woman who's living in rural New Jersey. And it's about her sort of interesting family and whatnot. It doesn't sound like the most sort of interesting thing, but I watched a few minutes of it and it's suddenly quite compelling, but not quite as compelling as Paris in Love, which is a new series on Peacock in the US, but we haven't got it here in Australia yet. It's Paris Hilton getting married and, you know, being an adult woman.
I love me some Paris Hilton. In fact, I'm going through quite a early aughties resurgence in my household. We're watching season 2 of Hill's The New Beginning. We're about to see the return of Kristen Cavallari. It is quite a moment in our televisual culture.
You have besmirched this podcast in a significant way. There's another film on Netflix that's probably worth noting. It's a rom-com called Love Hard, and it stars an actress named Nina Dobrev, who I know I've seen that name around the place. I can't say I'm that familiar with her. It's about an LA girl who gets catfished effectively, but the co-star in it is Jimmy O Yang, who people would know from Silicon Valley. He's a very strange Asian American performer. I assume he's the guy that's catfishing her, and the idea of that sounds hilarious, so I'm very keen to check that one out.
Okay, so there's plenty to watch on your small screens this week. Let's have a look at this week in history. One particularly of relevance to you, Dan Barrett, given the title of the show. November 14, 1988, one Murphy Brown, starring Candace Bergen, premiered on CBS and became quite the cultural sort of pin in the map, you could say. So much was spoken of the climate at the time through the Murphy Brown show, and it became a fairly iconic sort of a television series.
Yeah, look, the show, it's actually fairly unwatchable now. If you go back and watch an old Murphy Brown, like, man, it is a chore to get through, but she is such an amazing character. And I kind of wish that the reboot of the series that they did, about 3 years ago now, had tried to actually re-enliven the character rather than sort of go back and try to do the old show, but in a new context. Like, there was something to do with her and they just didn't do it. But November 15, 1986, what are we talking about here? Oh, okay, we've got the second time that, sorry, Simon writes these out for me and this is me being surprised by what happened this day in history. On the 15th of November, 1986, we've got the second time that SNL used a time delay. And the reason for this was that comedian Sam Kinison had been just basically being Sam Kinison.
Yeah.
So they looked at him going, look, there's no way that we can really put this out live as the premise of the show is. So let's time delay Kinison and make sure that he doesn't do anything to Sam Kinison. Sam Kinison?
And it was the second time in history. The first time was all the way back in 1975 when a similarly unpredictable comedian in Richard Pryor came on screen and hosted the SNL and had that now infamous back and forth with Chevy Chase on screen where a certain word was dropped that is just banned today, is just unforgivable, but made for a fairly incredible moment of television back in 75. In 1987, on November 16, actress Lisa Bonet marries singer Lenny Kravitz. Who'll ever forget the Who magazine covers that inspired? On November 18, 1980, Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate premiered. Now, it became one of the biggest box office bombs of all time, cost careers and dollars everywhere you turned. Having watched it again, having watched the director's cut many times over, I love Heaven's Gate. I think it's an incredible film. The biggest problem with it is that it's a 90-minute story in a three-hour movie. But apart from that, Heaven's Gate is an extraordinary work.
Now, I actually saw a little bit of Heaven's Gate for the first time like 3 or 4 months ago. Not more than about 10, 15 minutes worth of it. But I have to say, it's an entirely different film than I thought it was.
In what way?
I just had no idea really what the film was, apparently. November 19, 1980, CBS TV banned a Calvin Klein jean ad starring Brooke Shields. Why would you do that? Why?
I'll have to research that. Birthdays, November 13, 1938. The beautiful actress Jean Seberg, who was portrayed by the beautiful actor and Kristen Stewart a couple of years ago in a terrific film. She was born. She's led an amazing life, Jean Seberg. She was this massive star overseas, born in the US but largely shunned by the American public. She became a massive European star in films like Breathless. She returned to Hollywood for that awful musical Paint Your Wagon. And she passed away in 1979 in very tragic circumstances. So if you want to have a look up some of the great sort of hit-miss stories of Hollywood history, have a look at Jean Seberg.
Yeah, politically interesting.
Very interesting, yes.
1962, one Laura San Giacomo, born on November 14. And, of course, we know her best from Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Pretty Woman, Saving Grace, and you forgot the most important one of all, Simon, her sitcom, Just Shoot Me.
November 15, 1991, American actor Shailene Woodley was born. She had a huge hit with The Fault in Our Stars. November 18...
Interesting Shailene Woodley fact.
Yes.
Makes her own deodorant. Doesn't have a TV.
Really? Oh, she's one of these.
Yeah, she's one of those sorts.
Hippie types, eh? November 18, 1970, Megyn Kelly, the American television news anchor and journalist, most infamously with Fox News, but has made sort of a second career for herself with NBC. She was born. And the lady who inspired our middle bit, the wonderful Meg Ryan, November 19, 1961, she was born. Few actresses flew as high as her in sort of the 80s and 90s with the Top Gun, Inner Space, Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle, rolling wave of hit movies. And now she lives sort of this Greta Garbo type life in, you know, stumbling around the streets of New York in her Ugg boots, as far as I can tell. So it's an extraordinary career path for Meg Ryan, who I adored and still adore, but would love to see her on screen a bit more.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Simon Foster, you've got a film festival to get along to.
Oh my God, I forgot all about that.
I've got... Yeah, I've got some TV to watch. Actually, I've got some screeners for next week's podcast. So I need to get onto that immediately and try to get ahead of myself a bit.
Watch that and read through the running sheet too. That's always a good idea.
Read through the running sheet? Are you talking about the one that you put together about 5 minutes before the podcast gets recorded?
That's right, that one, yeah.
Okay, folks, let's get out of here. You are listening to Screen Watching. My name is Dan Barrett. I'm on Twitter. You can find me at the Dan Barrett. If you want, and it's a suggestion, it's not a demand, but actually, no, it's a demand. Start your day with my free newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. You can find it at alwaysbewatching.com. It's got the big stories in TV, streaming, and film. And on Fridays, there's the Always Be Streaming newsletter, which recounts the big shows that launched that very week.
I'm on the Twitter at SimonRFoster1. You can read my words over at screen-space.net. Haven't done much there lately because I've been going a little bit crazy with the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival. By the time this podcast hits the airwaves, that may have already finished, but you can go to our online festival platform, zerb.tv, X-E-R-B.tv. Just search for Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival, and you can watch 20 feature films and upwards of 70 short films there that I've programmed from all over the world. If you're still keen on anything to do with screen watching, go to the YouTube channel where there's uncut interviews and fresh trailers. This week, an interview with a director called John Gruters went up there, whose film Sabina is going into self-releasing patterns all around Australia this weekend. It's been a fun week, Dan Barrett.
Indeed it has. If you do like this podcast, do follow Screen Watching via your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe or follow button, whatever language your podcast app uses, and it means that the podcast automatically downloads for you each and every week. Simon Foster, it's been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully we can repeat it again next week.
All right, mate. All the very best. Bye-bye, everyone.